From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, with measles spreading in other states, we look at what the outbreaks could mean for Wisconsin. Then, Milwaukee leaders share their concerns about recent ICE arrests at the Milwaukee County Courthouse.
It's unprecedented that ICE would make arrests in a sensitive public space, which we consider the courthouse to be.
Plus, we get some financial advice on this tax day.
Budgeting is an exercise that you should be returning to regularly and like messing with regularly. My percentages never stay in one place. They always flex according to where I live, what I'm doing, what my priorities are. Be gentle with yourself.
Plus, we'll learn how climate change has affected management of Milwaukee's water and sewer system. All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Measles is spreading in the United States. What started as a few cases in West Texas has spiraled into hundreds sickened around the nation. Most of the affected people are unvaccinated children. At least two have died, and dozens have been hospitalized. With major outbreaks in Indiana and Ohio, it may be only a matter of time before the disease comes to Wisconsin, where the impact could be dire. Wisconsin has one of the lowest vaccination rates for measles in the nation, much lower than any of the states with active outbreaks. Dr. Ben Weston is the Chief Health Policy Advisor for Milwaukee County and an Associate Professor at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about what the measles outbreaks could mean for Wisconsin.
Right now, what do vaccination rates look like in Wisconsin and Milwaukee specifically?
Yeah, so when we look at vaccination rates in Wisconsin, what we see actually is that we're quite a bit lower than most other states. So for example, among kindergartners, this data is from 2023, but it's the most recent data we have. Only 85% of kindergartners were vaccinated against measles. And when we compare ourselves to other states, we're actually the third worst in the country. We see this outbreak in Texas. We see cases exploding in Ohio now. We're far worse than either of those states with our vaccination rates. So we really are at risk here in Wisconsin.
Yeah. We're at around 85%. What is the percentage necessary for herd immunity?
Yeah, so we heard a lot about herd immunity back during COVID, and the basic idea of it is that if you get enough people vaccinated, it's just hard for the disease to spread because it can't really jump person to person to person very easily. And that number for measles is around 95%. Now, what's important is the measles vaccine is extremely effective, and that's why you have this herd immunity. The vaccine is about 97% effective. And so when you hit that threshold of 95% of folks vaccinated, it's just really hard for this virus to spread. And to give context to this, this is one of the most contagious viruses out there. If you're in a room, there's about a 90% chance that you're going to be exposed to this virus if somebody else has it. So it's an extremely contagious virus. But if we can get those vaccination rates high enough, we can certainly protect folks.
I think people are aware that it's contagious, maybe not quite as contagious as it actually is. They might not be quite that aware, but there are still people who look at the risks of measles and for whatever reason are not persuaded by these risks. If a child contracts measles, what can happen?
Yeah. So when somebody gets measles, it usually starts off as many viruses do, with a flu-like illness. You might have fevers, you might have fatigue, congestion, cough. The problem is that in a fair portion of the population, it progresses and gets worse than that instead of just getting better. So one out of five people with measles actually gets hospitalized. That's a huge hospitalization rate, 20%. And then about 1 in 1,000 gets brain swelling. And even higher than that, 2 to 3 out of 1,000 people die. And those numbers may sound low, but we're approaching 1,000 people now in the United States that have contracted measles this year. As of yesterday, it was 712 people. And that's why we're seeing, unfortunately, these deaths from measles. This fits with the statistics that we've seen. It fits with those 2 to 3 people out of 1,000 dying from measles.
generally, who is most at risk of getting measles? Because I have certainly the perception that it is largely children, but obviously there are more people beyond that who can get it.
Yeah, anybody can be at risk for measles. Now, the people who are at risk of getting sick from measles tend to be younger kids, older adults, folks with immunocompromised. But when we look at the 712 confirmed cases so far across the United States, the majority of them are young people. About a third of them are under 5 years, and then it jumps up to about 40% of them as you get to the 5 to 19-year-olds. And so most of them are in kids. Now, part of that is because it's a newer trend to not get vaccinated. Our vaccination rates were much higher when you look 10, 15, 20 years ago. And so a lot of adults are vaccinated, were vaccinated back when they were young. But a lot of kids these days are not getting vaccinated. And so that's, I think, why we're seeing more cases in young people. And then, of course, young people are in communal settings a lot more, that being school. And so being in school, you're just exposed to other people, and you're more likely to have spread of disease. That's why all of us parents out there have kids who are congested and coughing all winter long. But thankfully for measles, there's an effective vaccine to prevent this more severe disease.
Do we know why vaccination rates are so low, especially in Wisconsin? We are the third worst for vaccinations for measles in the United States.
Yeah, across the country, we've seen a decline in vaccination. And certainly COVID was part of it, but it's been going on longer than COVID. When we look around Wisconsin, for example, we see significant declines over the last 10 years. So in Richland County, for example, in 2013, we were at about 83% vaccinated. Now we're down to 65%, just an incredibly low number of folks who are getting their vaccines. Bayfield County is another one, 86 or 87%, down to about 70%. And there's other counties that are even lower. Monroe County is down to below 60%. And so we have these counties throughout Wisconsin where the vaccination rates are getting so low that it just makes us a tinderbox waiting for an outbreak here as well, should a case of measles arrive in those communities. But certainly there's been a lot of misinformation, a lot of disinformation out there about the measles vaccine. But look, if you're a parent, there's three things you need to know. Number one is the measles vaccine is safe. It's been around for over 50 years. It's a proven vaccine. It's not anything brand new. We have tons of data on it, and it's incredibly safe. Number two, it's incredibly effective, 97% effective against measles. And again, that data is over decades. And number three, it's easy to get. The Milwaukee Health Department is offering the measles vaccine. You can call your local health department, drugstores, primary care providers. You can get the vaccine in so many different places. It's easy to get, it's accessible, and it's safe.
A lot of the counties you mentioned are in more rural parts of the state. And one of the things I think many of us have been concerned about is access to care just generally. Throughout Wisconsin, a lot of rural hospitals rely on immigrant doctors. We, of course, have a variety of things that are becoming roadblocks for immigrants in the United States. It's concerning when so much of our healthcare really relies on these people. Is Wisconsin right now prepared for a major outbreak of something like measles? How are we prepared right now?
Yeah, a few thoughts on that. I mean, any barriers we put up to folks getting healthcare broadly or vaccines more specifically are going to be detrimental to the health of individuals, the health of families, and the health of communities. Are we prepared? I think the vaccination rates show that we are not as prepared as we could be. Higher vaccination rates help to bolster a population and be more prepared when a disease emerges. And we're certainly seeing measles reemerge. It's important to remember, 20 years ago, measles was considered eradicated from the United States. There were not cases of measles. And of course, now we're seeing this rise again. Funding public health, supporting public health, and getting information out there about the safety and effectiveness and availability of vaccines is going to be critical.
When should we become concerned here in Milwaukee and Wisconsin more generally? It seems like this epidemic has been moving through different states. Texas as you said, much higher vaccination rate than we have. Ohio, higher vaccination rate. We are surrounded by states where the vaccination rate is below what we would consider herd immunity for measles. When should parents and people in general start to become pretty concerned?
We're surrounded, as you mentioned, by states with low vaccination rates. We have the lowest of the states that surround us. We're also surrounded by states that are seeing outbreaks of measles. There's 20 cases in Ohio. We're seeing cases now in Indiana, in Michigan, in Minnesota. Almost all the states that surround us are seeing cases of measles. So I would say it's probably a matter of time. You look at the trends, the cases are not slowing in the United States. So the chances of us having a case here in Wisconsin, unfortunately, are high. And so I think now is the time to think about this. Now is the time to be prepared, not to panic, but to be prepared and to ensure that your family, your children, your loved ones are vaccinated. If you have questions about the vaccine, reach out. Talk to the people that you talk to about everything else health-related in your life. It might be your primary care doctor, your family practice doctor, your pediatrician, whoever it is that you trust. Talk to them. Ask them about the vaccine if you have any questions, and make sure that your child is vaccinated. You can look it up on the Wisconsin Immune Registry online and make sure that your child is fully vaccinated and that you are as well.
Now, if you're a person for whom vaccination is not an option, either you are unable to get it for health reasons, or perhaps you have a child who is below the age where it is safe to get one of these vaccinations, how do you protect yourself?
Yeah, I mean, the good news is the vast majority of people either have protection or are able to get protection. And so if you think that for some reason you are not able to get the vaccine, that's another great reason to talk to your healthcare provider. There's a lot of folks out there, I think, who have heard misinformation or disinformation about whether they're eligible for certain vaccines. And so if you think you're not, ask. Verify. This is a great time to reach out and verify that really you might not be eligible, because that is a tiny, 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 tiny fraction of the population. But in general, you want to make sure you're protected, especially if you're going to areas. There's a lot of cases in Texas right now. If you're going down to Texas, if you're going to other communities where there's high rates of measles right now, you want to make sure you're protected. Now, the good news is most people are. Most people got their normal vaccines when they were kids. Most of our kids out there got the normal vaccines when they were younger. But certainly if you're not in that category, you want to be cautious. And ideally, you want to go out and get yourself protected.
If the worst happens, if someone in your life gets measles and they are showing symptoms, when do you become concerned? When do you make sure you're in a hospital?
Yeah, so, you know, measles starts off, again, in a very general sort of way with things that look like any other cold, any other viral thing out there. But then it turns into a rash, and then you can have the complicating symptoms. So certainly if you are unvaccinated and you're in the area of an outbreak and you start to have symptoms that seem like measles, even without the rash, that's a good time to reach out to a healthcare provider. If you don't have the vaccine, you don't have that protection. But for anybody out there, if you have these symptoms and then a rash starts to develop, you'd want to reach out to your healthcare provider for a couple of reasons. One is we need to track where measles is occurring and make sure it's not spreading to other people. And the other is to watch closely. You know, 1 out of 5 is a large number of people that end up getting sick, getting pneumonia, getting organ damage, getting all these different things that measles can lead to. And so if you have those symptoms, you have that rash, or if you have concerns, reach out to your healthcare provider.
All right. Well, Dr. Weston, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Ben Weston is the Chief Health Policy Advisor for Milwaukee County and the Medical Director for Milwaukee County's Office of Emergency Management. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. In recent weeks, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE agents, arrested 2 men at the Milwaukee County Courthouse, a space many used to consider safe for all people, regardless of immigration status. As the rules and norms around immigration enforcement shift, WUWM is introducing a new segment called The Check-In, Voices from Milwaukee's Changing Immigration Landscape. Today, WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez spoke with Milwaukee County Supervisor Caroline Gomez-Tom about the implications of the ICE arrests at the county courthouse.
I think the place to start on all of this is that over the past couple of weeks, ICE has detained multiple people at the courthouse. So what do we know about what happened and how it happened?
So what we know what happened was that ICE came into the courthouse and detained two individuals on two separate days. Beyond that, we know very little about if they had a judicial warrant or not, which shouldn't be allowable if they don't have a judicial warrant. We don't really know. Well, really, we didn't know that they were in the building until it happened, especially the second one that happened on April 3rd. My understanding was not even the sheriff's department knew that they were in the building.
What authority does ICE have in Milwaukee County's courthouse to make these kind of arrests?
Essentially, any law enforcement, they technically have the right to make arrests in public spaces. However, it's unprecedented that ICE would make arrests in a sensitive public space, which we consider the courthouse to be. So having them in our hallways unknowingly arrest someone who was there for their own due process is just really unfathomable and frankly loses a lot of trust from the public.
Last week, you were a part of a cohort of elected officials and immigrant attorneys that came together to have this press conference at the courthouse to kind of speak out against these actions. And you were greeted there by a counter protester.
Okay, here's supervisor. Yeah.
And after that exchange, something that the lawyers brought up was the procedure of due process. And I know you're a county supervisor and not an immigration attorney, but what exactly is due process and why does it matter here, regardless of status?
So due process is the right that we all have under the Constitution, that we cannot be deprived of life, liberty, and property without ensuring fair government procedure in figuring out if we are guilty or not of said crime. So essentially, our freedom can't be taken away at a given whim. And then it also adds that the government cannot act arbitrarily or unfairly. And the way that ICE has functioned, especially as of these last several months, where we're hearing of even U.S. citizens being detained by ICE, which is absolutely ridiculous. And what we're trying to do at the county board is to make sure that we are protecting our county-run spaces, especially the courthouse, where thousands of people come in every day for a various number of resources and services, and that they don't feel that their freedoms are at risk.
That's a great point, because I think when people think of the courthouse, they think of it as just a place for criminal or civil proceedings. But there are a lot of other reasons why someone would need to utilize the courthouse. So what are some of those reasons that community members, again, regardless of status, would need to access resources at the courthouse?
Absolutely. So there could be people going there for jury duty. People could be going to the Register of Deeds to get a birth certificate or a land deed. People could be going to the county clerk to pay off some of their taxes on their property. Sorry, the treasurer's office. People could be going to get a marriage license from the county clerk. People could be reporting an issue regarding like domestic violence that they're experiencing. There's also a lot of like legal support resources at the courthouse. So if they have a legal question, and you know, even in some cases around their immigration status, mind you, they could be coming in for legal advice with some of the clinics that host office hours at the courthouse. Really, there's so many different resources that people go to the courthouse for, and we want people to come to the courthouse for. And if they feel that that space is no longer safe, they're not going to. And that also includes for people who are going through the court system. We want them to show up. We want them to attend their hearings and attend, because that is part of the justice system. And by people not wanting to participate in that system as well, we're making our whole community less safe.
What have you been hearing from constituents in this time where ICE's presence is so much more visible both in the city and these sensitive places like the county courthouse? And then also, what is being done on your end and what can be done in a time like this?
That's the question at hand, isn't it? How people are feeling. And this has been the case since there's been word that there were going to be more ICE raids and ICE concerns, but there's people just not engaging at all in our communities. I come from a public health background, and I help people access Medicaid and other health coverage. And we hear of people not enrolling or disenrolling even their U.S.-born children from these programs because they're concerned that it puts them at risk for being identified and targeted and profiled and then potentially separated from their families. And that's just because of what's happening in the news. So when we actually have evidence of something like this happening in our community, and for me as a county board supervisor in a space that I technically represent and connect people to, I can only imagine how my constituents and community feel. So for me, this is serious. And I'm thankful that our county board is taking this very seriously. So we are introducing a resolution on Tuesday to help draw some limits to how ICE can maneuver in our public spaces, because at minimum, we would like to not see any more detentions in the courthouse. But if for some reason they show up in our public spaces, because that's how they are deciding to maneuver now, we are going to have limitations to address that. And so we're going to be asking the chief judge of the First Judicial District, along with the Office of the County Executive and the Sheriff's Department, to work together to come up with a plan on how to proceed and safeguard people coming into the courthouse. We want ICE to operate inside the limits of the law. And that means, you know, if they're going to come to the courthouse, having a judicial warrant signed by a federal judge. And we want to make sure that we're putting out resources across the courthouse and other county locations that educate people on their rights, so they have information about what to do in those situations where they encounter ICE.
That was Milwaukee County Supervisor Caroline Gomez-Tom talking with WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. Coming up later in the show, we talk to the longtime leader of the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District about his push for green infrastructure. But first, we'll learn how to be more confident managing money from a financial advisor. Keep listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, April 15th, is Tax Day, the due date for federal and state of Wisconsin tax returns. Filing your taxes might have you reflecting on your finances. For tips on improving one's financial health, WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez talked to author and financial educator Berna Anat. Anat describes herself as a financial hype woman and rich auntie in training.
A lot of your work, like you said, you're focused on first-gen folks, people of color, people that just haven't grown up with or had the option of generational wealth and what that could mean to for safety and all these things. And then thinking of money that way, it's not just money, right? It's shame, it's trauma. This is a big question, but what are some of the hangups you see in the way that we kind of have relationships with money that could unstick us from a debt journey or help us on our way through a debt journey?
Oh, for sure. That's a great question. I will say straight up that everybody in the club has shame. Everybody in the club has shame about money to some degree, to some flavor, because for so many BIPOC families, for second gen families, immigrant families, the kind of resounding theme is, oh, we don't talk about money. Most of the people I work with come from families where they either didn't talk about money at all, or the ways that money was talked about was already preloaded with shame and guilt or not enoughness. And to be clear, these things are not just like magical feelings that like came down from above, like our ancestors just sort of gave us this baggage. This is stuff set up systemically. You know, a lot of again, immigrant, first-gen BIPOC families, in their histories or even in their immediate lineage, they felt the actual effects of being underpaid. Like any kind of wealth-building tactics are totally kind of out of reach for them. Getting the information gatekept, actual like colonization, pillaging of their wealth, however many generations back. From there, we're taught these messages of shame, of because you don't have enough, that's your fault. I'm going to be a little bit of like a bootleg, completely unlicensed mental health person because I love that stuff.
Okay. We're here for it.
Just like know that this is like incredibly unlicensed words, but I am going through my own. I've been going through my own therapy journey and understanding that things, for example, in like our personal relationships and romantic relationships, there are things that we've learned from our parents and our caregivers that we carry on into our adult relationships. Same exact thing for our money brains. There are things that we learn from our caregivers and the world around us that we bring into our adult financial behaviors. So I just really want to invite a lot of, again, grace, space, understanding it's not easy to be the person kind of in between generations trying to figure it out and stop the cycle, because it's a big ask. It's a big lift.
So I want to play a little game with you. I mined some questions from folks around Milwaukee. And when I told them I was talking to you, I was just like, do you have anything to ask your future rich auntie? What would you like her to give you advice on? So would you be up to answer some of their questions?
Oh, 100%. I'm always trying to practice my future auntie like self. So let's go.
Okay, perfect. So the first one, can I trust Google to teach me how to budget because my rent is high? How much should I be spending and saving?
Great question. It's really common now to just turn to the Googles or the ChatGPTs and be like, help, fix it for me, please. I would trust Google to a certain degree in that it might give you the general information, like the sort of general advice of budgeting when your expenses are super high. This general advice you might find through the Googles is the 50-30-20 rule. And so that's kind of been the party line for many, many years. That rule says your budget, I'm putting lots of air quotes around things, that if you're budgeting your money, 50% of your money, quote unquote, should go to your expenses. These are your needs. I call it my come get me bills, because if I don't pay these things, someone's going to come get me. Someone's going to be like, I need that light bill. I need that, you know, health insurance bill. Your rent is supposed to fit in that 50%. This is where I lose a lot of people already. They're like, 50, what?
Yeah. Supposed to be rent 50%? In which year?
Exactly. Yeah. Which decade? Whom's ancestors is paying 50%? And then 30% of your money, quote unquote, should go towards your wants, you know, entertainment and fun and things you don't necessarily need for survival. And then that last 20%, quote unquote, should go towards your financial goals. So that's savings, that's putting extra down on debt, investing extra for retirement and things like that. Now, if you're a person that's like, my rent is high and it will not fit inside of that 50%, you got to be able to stretch it and flex it to what works for you. The problem with the 50-30-20 rule is that it makes people read, the majority of us in major cities, be like, oh my God, I'm broken. Something's wrong with me. But please know that when I was on like an aggressive debt payoff journey, I would say my like that 20% became like 40%. I had to go all the way down on my like regular expenses. And then before that, my 50% was actually 70%. A lot of people see the 50-30-20 rule and they're like, oh, well, budgeting's not for me. I don't fit in there. It's really about customizing it to where your life actually is and giving yourself a lot of time to see where your percentages fall, knowing that budgeting is an exercise that you should be returning to regularly and like messing with regularly. My percentages never stay in one place. They always flex according to where I live, what I'm doing, what my priorities are. It's a good place to start, but be gentle with yourself.
I appreciate the gentle approach, which kind of gets into another question I heard was the idea of not internalizing being a moral failure for living paycheck to paycheck. Even trying to think about money or how to save when someone's in survival mode.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Maybe it's because I woke up feeling spicy today, but I immediately feel defensive for this person that might feel like they are a moral failure for having debt. Now that I think it's because we tapped into this like auntie persona, I immediately feel very defensive for this person in that not only are you not a moral failure for having debt, because as I said before, debt is a tool that us living in this monopoly version of capitalism, we have had to leverage, we have been forced to leverage in a lot of ways, because that is how the system is set up. It is set up for us to have to choose debt and then have to pay a lot for that debt because of interest rates, be in debt for a long time, actually pay way more out of our nose because we had to take that debt. And also the system itself is set up so that you feel bad for having chosen the only thing that was available to you. I'm feeling anti-defensive because I'm like, no, you're beating yourself up over something that was never meant for you to win in the first place. So I want to give this person a hug and I want to get out in front of them between like them and the shame of capitalism and tell them that like, you are doing your best to survive. You're doing your best with the tools that you're being given. And by the way, the tools suck and they're not meant for you to thrive. So do what you can to shower the moral shame off, because these debt companies absolutely are using no kind of moral compass to deal with you. It's not worth the energy.
Hmm. Last question. And I got a lot of work questions too, but this comes from people who feel like they're either starting a job or they've left a lot of money on the table when they started a job because they didn't know how to ask for a raise. Please teach us how to ask for a raise.
Ooh, okay. Goodness. I will say I am not necessarily a negotiation queen. I'm thinking about one person who is an incredible resource. Their name is Mandy Woodruff, and they are the like hopping jobs negotiation queen. But one thing I learned from Mandy is when you are negotiating, for example, inside of a job and you're trying to get a higher wage for a job you already have, or you're like want a promotion, something I learned from Mandy is that you want to make the case irresistible. So understanding that today you want to ask for, you like would like to ask for a raise in the future, put a sort of like goal date for yourself 6 months from now that you are going to be like officially asking for that raise in 6 months. Let your manager or whoever your bosses know, I'm going to be asking for this raise in 6 months. I'm looking to this for these reasons. And in 6 months, I'm going to give you a case as to why I deserve that. And then spend that period of time building up your case, basically creating as much of a paper trail of the impact you make in that company as possible. It's important to let your team know that you're going to be asking for that raise, because then it gives them the time to sort of figure out the mechanics around that ask on the higher level while you build your case. You are like putting together data of like impact you have on the customers. You're putting together data on events that you threw and like how that helped the company's bottom line. You're putting together testimonials on customers who thought that you were like the best barista ever. And also checking in with your boss along those 6 months so that by the end of those 6 months, it doesn't feel like you're making a case to the boss. It feels like you and the boss are making a case to their boss. It's like the two of you are now on this like journey to make this right and get a yes to the person above them. Mm-hmm. Because it's not really, it doesn't work great if it's like you versus your boss getting a raise, because the boss also has somebody to answer to. If you help that boss make it easy to present you to somebody higher than them, that could see a lot of success.
I can imagine that a lot of people will hear this and wonder, how do I get my own Berna, or where do I find you? Should they work with a financial planner? What would your advice be for where people should go if they're in the place where they can look for this kind of help?
We need community. We need people to help us. And I would say the best place to start looking for a financial planner is a resource like XY Planning Network. You can go on, and what I love about XY Planning Network, you could find a certified financial planner that is fee-based and not commission-based, is my advice. And you could also filter for your life. You can filter for people at certain intersections of life. Maybe you are like mid-career and you're trying to start a family. Also, you are looking for someone in a specific ethnicity set and you want someone who understands like queer family building. You can filter for all of that in XY Planning Network and find a financial professional that understands your life. Because what we're seeing on the New Dime side and helping people connect to financial professionals that they trust is it is a horrible experience to like have a sit down with a financial planner that doesn't get you and is like, why would you put aside that savings for your mom in the Philippines? Like that's not something that my family would do. So like, don't do it. Like, why would you think about caregiving for your family in the future? Why don't you have them do it themselves? It's an awful experience to get gaslit by a financial planner that doesn't get the specifics of your personal life. And so look for that and filter for that in something like XY Planning Network.
Berna, thank you so much for taking the time and sharing just, it was a lot, but just tidbits of your knowledge today. I appreciate it so much. Thank you for talking with me.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to come on and financially auntie anytime.
Okay, cool.
Berna Anat is an author and financial educator. She spoke with WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez earlier this year. We've got a new season of Bubbler Talk going, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Coming up, we talk to the executive director of the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District about changes to the city's green infrastructure. That's next on Lake Effect on WUWM. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Things like rain barrels or rain gardens are pretty common in the Milwaukee area for both businesses and residential homes. But at the beginning of Kevin Schaefer's tenure leading the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District, it was extremely hard to convince people about the benefits of green infrastructure. In fact, MMSD was unpopular, even hated in the past. During the so-called sewer wars, Milwaukee's sewer system released untreated wastewater into streams, rivers, and Lake Michigan an average of 60 times a year. Today, that's down to just a couple times a year. That's thanks in large part to Schaefer's leadership of MMSD since 2002. His time and work with the organization was highlighted last year in Milwaukee Magazine. I spoke with Kevin Schaefer about his tenure with MMSD. Kevin, welcome to Lake Effect.
Audrey, it's so nice to talk to you. Thank you for giving me this opportunity.
Of course. So before you took over as executive director at MMSD in 2002, you were running the district's engineering department starting in 98. So can you set the scene for me? What brought you to Milwaukee and what were your first impressions of the job and the atmosphere you were coming into?
Yeah, well, when I graduated from school, I went and worked for the Army Corps of Engineers for 6 years. And then I worked for private industry for 9 years after that. And it was through those final few years in private industry that I got to know MMSD. And the previous executive director interviewed and hired me to run the engineering division here at the district. And I started in October of 1998. And I just really, I wasn't here for the sewer war, so I wasn't here for all that background noise that was going on. But it was just a great challenge to be able to run an engineering department of, I don't know, 50 people, and to have such a great mission that we were working on. So it just seemed like a good fit for me.
When did your interest in water resources and quality start?
You know, it probably started when I was a kid. Grew up in central Illinois. My grandparents had a farm, so I remember doing a lot of fun things in creeks and handling cow manure and things like that. So it was just something that I kind of acquired as I grew up.
And you mentioned the sewer wars that were happening before you came on to MMSD. For anyone who's unfamiliar or maybe doesn't remember it, can you explain why MMSD was not very popular, to say it kindly?
Well, in 1972, the Clean Water Act passed, and almost immediately after that, the city of Milwaukee was sued for combined sewer and separate sewer overflows into Lake Michigan by my home state, Illinois and Chicago. And so we were forced at that time to build the deep tunnel and to make improvements to our treatment plants. And so the sewer wars was a discussion about, it was a battle. It was a battle over who was going to pay for the deep tunnel and for some of those improvements, basically pitting the in-Milwaukee County communities against the out-of-Milwaukee County communities.
And a big issue during this time was untreated wastewater overflowing into lakes and rivers. That was up to 60 times a year at that point.
Yeah, that's correct. We averaged 50 to 60 per year. So that was, I mean, there's much more than that in some years. And it was about 8 to 9 billion gallons of wastewater going into the rivers and into Lake Michigan every year on average.
Yeah, obviously today it's very rare for this to happen, but a lot happened in between that, right, to get us to where we are. And when you started as MMSD's executive director in 2002, what were some of the most pressing challenges you were facing at first?
Well, there was a lot of media attention, none of it real positive. And one of the things that was happening at the time was when we finished completion of the deep tunnel in 1994, we let an algorithm, a computer algorithm, kind of manage the tunnel system. And up until 2002, we would basically have an overflow if the tunnel was half full, because we were saving that extra space for future rainfalls. And, you know, rightfully so, we were getting a lot of poor media coverage because we still had half the storage available and not using it. So in 2002, when I became executive director, first thing I did was change that. And instead of a computer making that call, I said, you know, if I'm going to be out in the media defending an overflow, I want to be the one that makes that decision. So I guess I took the horns and said, I'm going to make this happen, and I'm going to do the call myself. And that meant a lot of 2 o'clock in the morning phone calls, all night wake ups, just trying to manage storms. And but what it did was it really brought a more personal touch to what we were doing. And I think the public appreciated that.
Especially given that you were a new leader, I imagine you were nervous about taking on this role and people were most likely skeptical of you, right? So what's your leadership style and how do you think it helped you either establish new relationships or repair old ones?
Well, I'm a pretty calm guy. I try not to get too worked up out on the outside for folks to see the issues. And so I really just started looking at what the problems were and quietly working towards solutions on that, whether it was an internal project that we were working on, or whether it was working with the 28 municipalities, their mayors and village presidents, just going out and meeting with them, giving them a personal relationship with me, allowing them to call me if they needed to on anything. And I mean, my staff would tell you, and I, you know, I think it's true, I don't get into the weeds on some of these issues. I try to kind of hover above that and make sure that they're pointed in the right direction. But the day-to-day calls on a lot of things, I really have my staff do a lot of that decision-making.
Another big part of the shift you helped kind of lead was an emphasis on education in relation to public relations, because people can easily see the result of wastewater overflow, right? But do they understand the process necessarily? So why did you feel, let's help everyone understand what actually happens in our water system?
Yeah, and thank you, Audrey, because that was one of the big changes early on. We would have an overflow and people would not understand why and what the mechanisms were and what the background was on that. So one of the things I also started doing was, I call it sewer school. I'm still doing sewer school. And I go around to nonprofit groups, schools, communities, Rotaries, Kiwanians groups, and talk about how the system works. But one thing that I did do, which was different, and it's different than what most utilities in the country today are doing, is I connected it to the entire watershed. I said, we cannot just look at our own political boundaries. The Milwaukee River comes downstream right through our sewer area, and it's got a huge drainage area up above us. So we really need to look at nature's boundaries, which is that watershed boundary, and start managing all types of flows on the watershed scale. And so that's the message I've been pushing with the sewer school effort, talking about how we manage stormwater, how do we manage wastewater, how do we integrate these systems so that they can work together to make our lives better.
Given that it takes a lot of time to steer the ship right, so with the tumultuous environment you're coming into, it didn't go away overnight. And in 2009, you almost quit MMSD. But what was the turning point for you that helped you make the decision to stay and to essentially commit your foot to the gas?
So in 2009, my dad passed away. And I thought, if I'm going to make a change, I need to make it now, because I wasn't sure that I would make it going forward. And I thought, well, let's make the change. We'll see what happens. It's either going to be really quick or, you know, I'll be here a while. So what I did was I stepped back from everything they were doing. And I thought about a milestone year of the year 2035. And I said, what do I want the district to look like in the year 2035? So I wrote in 2009, I wrote a vision for the year 2035. It really was focused on integrated watershed management and climate change. And in 2009, although we were living it then, it was still not widely accepted that the climate was changing. So put some pretty drastic or hard goals within that vision, and hit the send key thinking, well, you know, I'm either here for a while or I'm packing up tomorrow. And my commission wanted to extend it. So they wanted to have their own vision. So they formed a committee, took my vision that I wrote in 09 and basically approved that same vision in early 2010. And really that vision is still driving us today. And it was a great motivator for staff. They were able to look at this and say, okay, we're going to do take these steps. We're going to install green infrastructure. We're going to take these steps to try to address climate change while still meeting our permit with the state and federal government and doing better than those permit requirements.
What's the current main issue that you're prioritizing right now for MMSD? I know a lot of projects happen together and along the same timeline, but what stands out to you?
Everything's integrated, just like you said. It's all a kind of a puzzle that fits together, but we really have to turn our attention to climate change and really target these unique storms that we're seeing throughout the country now, the droughts that we're seeing that are causing fires. It's a huge task that we have to embark on. And again, I think focusing that discussion on a watershed makes sense because the impacts of climate change will be felt with air and with water. And so using nature's boundary for water, it makes sense to try to manage that resilience effort through different steps throughout the watershed. So we're purchasing land and keeping it from being developed along the waterways where it would be flooded. We're working with farmers upstream to do better farm practices to reduce pollution and runoff from their farms. We're working in the urban core of the city and in the suburbs to install green infrastructure, which is just taking nature's approach to managing stormwater, allowing it to infiltrate or to store it in rain barrels or in ditches or whatever, to try to keep it out of the sewers and to clean it before it gets into the river. So we're really looking at all these different puzzle pieces fitting together.
As some of the projects you mentioned, you know, it's kind of easy to take our surroundings for granted or not know the work a bioswale does as we drive past it. So can you share how Milwaukee and MMSD is a leader in innovation in this field? For example, what do you share with other people and organizations around the world about the work that you do?
Yeah, so I've gone to China, I've gone to different places throughout the United States talking about green infrastructure and really talking about how we need to manage that drop of rainfall where it falls. And really, it's really talking to people and going back to some of the very basic education that they had maybe in grade school, talking about the hydrologic cycle and how to manage water. So we focus on different elements of green infrastructure. The first one that we implemented was a rain barrel program. And, you know, I remember going to my son's eighth grade graduation and people laughing at me because I was promoting to put rain barrels at the bottom of downspouts. But as those efforts grew and as more and more came into operation, we're seeing more water being captured off those rooftops instead of going into the sewer system. So rain barrels, bioswales, as you talked about, a lot of the money that we're spending on green infrastructure, we actually give back to the communities. So the city of Milwaukee's done a magnificent job with some of the bioswales on their roadways. Whitefish Bay, I just drove through there yesterday and saw some beautiful bioswales. None of that would be there if MMSD had not pushed the green infrastructure program and paid for it. We're paying for almost all of that.
Nowadays, you see rain barrels almost at every other house. A lot of people are doing rain gardens and their own personal landscaping. What are some of your favorite projects that you pass by in your day-to-day?
Yeah, well, I always laugh when I'm walking the dog in the morning when I see a rain barrel because you never saw those before. So it's very satisfying to see that. You know, Pulaski Park is a flood management project, but we went into that park in partnership with Milwaukee County Parks. And we removed the concrete lining from that waterway and naturalized that creek as it flows through the park and then rebuilt the park so that it brings back better recreational components to the community. So really seeing that tie-in between the social benefits of better recreation, safe places for children to play, better places for families to gather, along with flood management, all kind of integrated into the same space, is very satisfying for me because you're getting multiple benefits for the same dollar amount.
Is it that satisfaction that's kept you at MMSD?
Oh, you know, we do something different every day. And it's that that change, that always looking to be better, the efforts to try to make this community more resilient to climate change with less flooding. That's the stuff that brings me every day. And mostly it's working with some really phenomenal people here at the district. We have great lab staff. We have great monitoring crews out in the field, engineering, accounting, my legal staff. Everyone is so passionate about what we do. And, you know, we're really hiring some great young talent now. And a lot of them say that they're coming to MMSD because they like the vision and the mission of what we're trying to do for the environment. So it's a win-win for everyone. And I just love the people that I work with.
Kevin Schaefer is the executive director of the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District. We spoke last year. That wraps up the show for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn how cuts to federal funding will impact food banks here in Wisconsin. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.